Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This episode of Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline.ag. The end of August is wild when it comes to sports action. With the Major League Baseball playoff race heating up, the UFC and an NFL season just about to start, it's time to try your hand at winning some cash. Get in the mix at BetOnline.ag and use promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now he's dominating the world of on-demand audio. And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
Hey, welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Every week, we are bringing out some of the most requested episodes of the podcast from behind the archives. We have another great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. It is producer Sean with episode number 202. That is Nightmare Danny Davis, original air date March 12th, 2015. Danny Davis, not to be confused with the disgraced WWF referee, Dangerous Danny Davis. Nightmare Danny Davis was a mainstay in the Memphis and Continental territories, where he initially worked with Steve Austin as an early opponent in Steve's USWA days. So Danny has played a significant role in not only Steve Austin's professional wrestling career, but also plenty of other WWE superstars in their careers, because Danny Davis is the founder of Ohio Valley Wrestling, or OVW, which many of you that listen to the show know that John Cena came from OVW, Batista came from OVW, Randy Orton came from OVW, Brock Lesnar, not to mention tons of other folks like Victoria, CM Punk, Shelton Benjamin. I mean, just a lot of names that eventually ended up in the WWE started out in OVW, because for a very long time, OVW was the training ground for WWE and its superstars of the future. And it's still going on today, still training folks to learn the craft of pro wrestling. So Danny talks about the promotion and how it came to be, his relationship with the WWE during that time, as well as his own professional wrestling career. As I mentioned, Danny Davis, known as one half of a tag team known as the Nightmares, where he was a tag team champion in the Continental, Alabama, Southern States area, as well as the Memphis area. He also talks about his impressions of Brock Lesnar, talks about the greatness of Rip Rogers, how Jerry Lawler helped him out in the past, and the King's generosity. There's a lot of good wrestling stories in here in this episode, and I think you guys will dig it. So before we get to this day in Steve Austin history, I just want to remind you, you got to check out Straight Up Steve Austin every Monday night after Raw. You can catch it this week with his guest, the man, Becky Lynch. I think, I'm pretty certain that's who it is, because you just had Baker Mayfield this past week, and he's going to have Becky Lynch next week. So make sure you set your DVRs, as Steve would say, and catch the latest episode of Straight Up Steve Austin. Also, stick around to the end of this episode, because you will hear Steve give a special announcement about his latest t-shirt line with Pro Wrestling Tees. Make sure you catch that, because you guys are going to snap those up real quick. All right, let's get to it. This day in Steve Austin history, today being August 29th, very late day as far as matches go. In 1991, in East Rutherford, New Jersey, a very rare WCW Northeast date, where WCW TV champion Steve Austin defeated Johnny B. Bad. And then in 1992, in Kansas City, Missouri, WCW TV champion Steve Austin defeated Ricky Steamboat. I got my information from the history of WWE.com. All right, folks, thanks for listening, and we'll come back after the break with another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Hey, college football fans, need to brush up on your football knowledge? Then enroll in the Dos Equis College Football College, where you'll learn from brilliant football minds like Jay Cutler, Martellus Bennett, Katie Nolan, and John Bacon, the man who wrote the book on college football. Not only will you win every football argument this season, you could even enter for a chance to win tickets to the 2020 College Football Playoff National Championship. So be the first in your family to earn a football watching certificate from a beer school. Enroll in Dos Equis College Football Football College at dosequis.com/edu. Dos Equis. Keep it interesante. Dos Equis Beer Brands. Enjoy Dos Equis responsibly. Imported by Cervezas Mexicanas, White Plains, New York. Copyright 2019. Dos Equis Beer Brands. No purchase necessary. 50 US/DC, 21 plus only. Enter by 12/20/19. Full rules available on dosequis.com/edu.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Boy, I welcome Danny to the show. He's listening on the line right now. I want to lay down a story about how this guy helped me way back in the days. I can't remember. I believe it was a spot show. Sometimes in about 1990, I'd been in the business for about, man, no longer than 6 months. And I'd been going around the loop, and Memphis was it was USWA territory. It was a weekly territory. We worked the same towns every single week, and then we'd swap out on a spot show every Thursday, so we never knew where Thursday was going to be. And one particular night, I noticed that I was going to be working with the Nightmare Danny Davis. And at the time, hell, I guess Danny had been in the ring for 10, 15 years. He was an established veteran, a hell of a damn worker, and a guy that I was just going to be all ears that night and listen to. And when I used to drive to the matches, I'd always think about what I wanted to do, because even at a very early age, because I don't hear very well, I was calling the bulk of my matches. But since I was working with an established veteran like Danny, this was going to be my turn to just sit back and listen and learn to a badass worker. So we get to the building, and I walked over to Danny, and I said, "Hey, Danny," I said, "what do you want to do?" He goes, "I don't know, Steve. You call it." And I told Danny, I said, "Man," I said, "I was looking forward to working with you so I can learn from you." And Danny told me, "I've seen what you can do. You'll be fine. If you get into a jam out there, I'll help you out." And so that was a guy who'd been working for as long as he had, that put his trust and confidence in me and let me test the waters against a vet like that. And it was a true class act. And I've always appreciated Danny for that. And we had some great matches. And that's who I'm talking with today on the podcast. Danny, how you doing?
Matt, I'm doing real good. And, you know, thanks for that introduction. You know, it really amazes me that with everything that you have accomplished in the wrestling / sports entertainment industry, that you remember that. Now, that touches my heart, that you remember that. But the story you told was as accurate as it was, because it was exactly how it unfolded.
But I tell you what, we ended up having a great match, and there was one thing, because I had a high spot. It was a transition type thing, and I wanted to start off being in motion, and then I wanted you to end up being in motion. And man, I told you kind of the dilemma that I was in, and you said, "Well, hell, go ahead and just call your high spot, then I'll go for a backdrop, just grab me, send me in, and I'll be the guy in motion." And it was problem solved in about 3 seconds. So it was little bitty things like that that always made the difference. And one other story I'll share real quickly. When we were working in somewhere, one of those little towns in Tennessee, as you remember so often, Danny, after the all the matches had been done, there was another main event. It was a grab for the green. It was a battle roll. Yep. It was just something to give the people another match, because we needed another match. And there were so many damn battle rolls, and you was always famous for your chops. And so anyway, I backed Danny in the corner and I chopped him 3 times, and my chops ain't shit. So I said, "Spin me around." And of course, when I said "spin me around," I meant that was time for me to take some chops from Danny Davis. Well, here's the thing. Danny was always known for being one of the hardest choppers in the history of the pro wrestling business. I don't know what you got for hands, Danny, that feel like damn leather or bricks. You lit me up about 3 times. And if you remember, I bailed out and ran away from your ass. I was eliminated from the battle roll, and I beat Danny to the dressing room. So I got a little piece of paper, and Danny had his locker room over there, and I wrote, "Fuck you and your chops." So by the time Danny came back from the match, I'd already taken a shower, and I was just waiting to see his reaction. And he sees this note in his locker, and he reads it, and he starts laughing his ass off, and he looks right at me, and it was kind of a rib. But do you remember that?
I do remember that. And the funny thing is, you eliminated yourself from the battle royal after those chops. But yes, you're exactly right. Back in my prime, I was known for that because I was always a little snug and aggressive in the ring, but that's kind of the way I was broke in, you know, and I kind of followed that through my career, you know. But
and I do
remember that very, very well.
And I did too. I mean, that was kind of my style too. I mean, I would like to work snug and believable. I wouldn't say strong style Japanese. Right. And you laid all your stuff in, as did I. And I was working with a couple of guys in that territory. And it was funny because they'd say, hey, man, you're kind of laying it in out there. And, you know, green as grass as I was, you know, I just kind of expected that's the way it was, or at least that was my interpretation of the business, and it continued to be for the rest of my career. But some people were taken aback to it in that USWA system. And so I just tell them, I said, yeah, man, just, you know, go ahead and just lay it back in. Because that's what I expected, even at that day and age. I knew you needed to be believable and credible.
Well, at that time, you know, in the business, that's one thing, you know, kayfabe was a big deal. And you absolutely had to make everything look, you know, 100% legit. And when you work snug, it always comes across as that. And I want to tell you a quick story. And I don't know that you remember this, but and I don't know that this had any bearing on anything that you did in your career, but we both spent a lot of time in USWA. That's actually where I got my break in the business. But at this particular time, we were at the Mid-South Coliseum on a Monday night in Memphis, and your paychecks, like everyone else, was really, really at a minimal. Yeah. And you and I were talking, and you brought up the idea that you thought you were going to go back to Texas and that you were basically done. I don't know if you remember this conversation, but I remember it as if it were yesterday. And I told you that I thought that would be a mistake for you because I see something in you. I said, I don't know what it is, but I see something in you that if you were to quit the business, it'd be a big mistake. Now, I don't know if you remember that conversation. I don't know if you ever, you know, took any of that to heart, but it begs the question, if you had gone home that week, would the Attitude Era ever have happened?
Man, that's a good question. And I can't remember at what point of my Tennessee stay that was, because when I first went down there, you know, I was making $15, $20 a night.
I know you.
Dude, that was maximum payment. And, you know, Dutch Mantel jumped in my car with me. Chris Champion jumped in the car. So they were paying for the gas. I was supplying the ride. I mean, we'd stop at a McDonald's to get a burger on the way home, and I couldn't afford a damn burger. And this is when I was eating all the potatoes and stuff like that. And dude, that was one of the funnest periods of my life. I was starving, but I was a sponge because I was getting to work. I mean, dude, you know all the talent that we had back then, some great people with psychology. So, I mean, I was absorbing all this. I think that conversation happened when, you know, I went back and Jerry Jarrett gave me a $100 a night guarantee. Now, mister, back in about 1991, for a guy that's been in the business for about a year, that was a lot of goddamn money. And, dude, so you broke in about 77, right?
You're exactly right. It was August of 1977. I lived in Collierville, Tennessee. I was manager of a retail store, and my mother called me and said, "Hey, Danny," she says, "I'm reading the paper here in Jackson, Tennessee," and she said, "There's an open tryout that says if you if anyone wants to learn to wrestle, be out behind the Jackson Coliseum at say like 4 p.m. on Thursday." So my mom and I always watched wrestling when I grew up. But I never, you know, back in those days, you know, there was no wrestling school anywhere to learn that craft. And so when she called and told me about this basically open tryout, I showed up and on this Thursday evening, and about 200 other people, guys and gals, showed up. And I was like, oh my, well, there's no way, you know, I'm going to get chosen to do this. And then a little bit later, a couple of guys come out and picked, I don't know, half a dozen people out of the crowd. And for whatever reason, I happened to be one of those guys that that got chosen. So they shuffled us in the back of the Coliseum and then shuffled us into a dressing room and basically said, well, we're going to put you out there in the crowd tonight, you know, in the ring, and let's just see what you can do. So, you know, went out there and with another guy that they chose, and we just wrestled around and you know, really embarrassed ourselves because we knew nothing. But, you know, I don't know what the purpose of that was other than to come to find out later that Buddy Fuller was the guy who was instrumental in having this open tryout. And for those who don't know, Buddy Fuller is Ron and Robert's dad, who was an old Tennessee wrestler back in the day, who actually owned most of the Tennessee territory in his day. So it was quite an opportunity for me, you know, to actually get started that way.
But getting started that way, then you got into the school, right? And then so what was the protocol or the format of the school, and how long did it take you to get your chops up when Buddy says, hey, man, I think you're ready to make your debut, your real in-ring debut, and get on the road?
Well, it's funny that you put it that way, because nowadays that's kind of the way it happens. But back then it didn't happen that way. Let me tell you how this unfolded. This was in August when I did the open tryout. Then after we had the match that night, Buddy gathers all together in the room there, the six of us that he chose, and says, you know, I'm thinking about opening up a little wrestling school down in Oliver, Tennessee, which was actually about 30 miles south of where I grew up. And he said, I got a farm down there. I got about 1,000 acres. He says, I'm going to put a ring up. He says, you might open a wrestling school. If you think you'd be interested, here's my number. Keep me in mind. Well, I didn't think really much of it. I kept his number. So come November of 77, I called Buddy, and he said, yeah, I remember you. He said, you thinking about coming in and being a part of this wrestling school? I said, yeah, I think I'd like to try it. So at the time, Steve, I was married and had three kids and had a nice job, you know, with benefits, the whole nine yards. I gave my notice, walked away. And come to find out, I had to move on this farm. I had to live on the farm Monday through Friday, and I was only allowed to leave on weekends. Come to find out again, not only was I not learning how to wrestle, but guess what I was learning what to do? I was learning farm chores, Steve. God damn. I was learning how to fucking milk cows. I was learning how to pick up stumps that were frozen in the Tennessee ground. And I was learning how to dig fence posts, you know, when it was fucking 0 degrees. Don't get me wrong, I got a good workout. But
you're married with three kids. All of a sudden, you're out on a farm 5 days a week working your ass out, but you ain't learning how to wrestle. What does your wife think about this bullshit situation?
Well, she thinks exactly what I was thinking, that I was a dumb son of a bitch for doing what I was doing. But I love the wrestling business, and I knew at some point there, you know, something was going to happen, because every morning, here was the routine, Steve. Every morning, we would awake at 6 a.m. We lived on a farmhouse on his property. We had a cook that came in and prepared our breakfast. And he fed us like kings. So we would have breakfast, and then at 7:30 we would put on farm clothes, and then we would all load up into his vehicles, and we would go out in the fields, and we would do farm chores from 7:30 until noon. At noon we would come back in, we would eat lunch, and then at 2 o'clock we would go back out in the fields to finish whatever farm chores we had. Then at 5 o'clock, that was when we quit. We would come back to the house. We wouldn't shower. We wouldn't clean up. We wouldn't even change clothes. But we would grab our gym bag, and then he would take us all down to the gym where the ring was. And that's where Terry Sawyer, who was an Olympic medalist wrestler, he would take and say, all right, boys, let's see how tough you are. And then he would wrestle us. He would stretch us. And, man, they had us doing every kind of calisthenic you can possibly imagine. And put us through the paces after, you know, a long, hard day of farm labor. Now, 15 individuals, and there were no women signed up at this time. No women, you know, joined this training camp. But there was 15 guys that started. And during some of these calisthenics on one day, Steve, two guys were duck walking around our gym floor. Two guys duck walked out the side door and never came back.
So how many people ended up finishing the class?
15 started, 5 finished, and only one guy made it in the wrestling industry.
Okay, now it's always seems like it'd be that was kind of the method of operation of all the old schools back in the day. Heavy-duty calisthenics, try to weed out the weak, find out who really wants it the most. So y'all went through that process. But then once you got in the ring, and now, you know, with your OVW school, we still got to get to that. But what was the training protocol back in? What was it, learning how to roll, learning how to fall, take bumps, and then get into some chain wrestling and basics? What was it?
Well, you know, you would really think that. But Steve, I never learned the first thing about pro wrestling at this school. I was taught how to hook. I was taught how to shoot. I was taught how to pull eyes out of socket. I was taught how to break bones. I was never taught one thing, and I was never smartened up to the business.
Are you shitting me?
No. Now, that begs the question. How did I actually get my start? Well, I got my start that way, but one day, Buddy Fuller put me and one other guy who was in the school in his twin-engine plane. We left Bolivar, Tennessee, his farm, and we flew to Tampa, Florida, where we went down and worked out at the world-famous Snake Pit at the time. That was my very first match. I got to actually perform on a TV taping. And it was me and this kid against, I want to say it was Steve Kern and Mike Graham when they were green.
Yeah.
And I had never had any schooling on television wrestling, nothing. And needless to say, you know, I got tossed around and this, that, and the other. And I knew enough to where what I saw on TV growing up and what I was being taught were two different things. I knew that. So I just kept my mouth shut, and I just went on about my business and did what was asked of me.
So what were you guys doing out there in the ring? Did you try to call any high spots, or was it purely kind of like damn near just a shoot wrestling match? Well, you know, with some work in there.
It was pretty much like a shoot wrestling match, right. But we were just cannon fodder for a young Steve Kern and a young Mike Graham.
Gotcha.
And you know, but we didn't know that because we weren't smartened up.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way it was. And then whatever happened. I wish I could remember, but I don't remember. But I'm sure they pinned me or my partner. But once we left Tampa and went back to Bolivar, Tennessee, Buddy then took us to Memphis, Tennessee, where they taped, you know, the live show every Saturday morning. And Buddy introduced me to Jerry Jarrett. He introduced me to Jerry Lawler, and he introduced me to Bill Dundee. And Buddy says, well, this guy, he's pretty salty, and, you know, he might be able to do you guys something. And he looked at me and says, okay, Danny, our business is over with. You know, you're on your own now. And this was in January of 1978.
Now, how old were you at the time?
I was 25, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, and like I said, had a wife, 3 kids, car payment, the mortgage, the whole 9 yards. Now, you know, I saved a little money up. We were able to pay bills for a while, but then it got tough, you know, because I'd gotten into this business and was getting, not only was I not trained, but, you know, obviously I wasn't getting booked. And come to find out, the reason I wasn't getting booked is Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee and Jerry Jarrett knew I had no skills, no television skills, but I knew how to do the shoot stuff. And I believe that no one wanted to get in the ring with me because they did not know what I was going to do.
Somebody get a goddamn break and learn how to start working.
Well, that's exactly what I did. I attended the Saturday morning TV tapings for over a year, and I sit back and I watched. I kept my mouth shut, and I listened, and I asked questions to the veterans with, you know, in a respectful way, and that's basically how I learned. And then one day, Lawler and Dundee gave me an opportunity to wrestle on TV, and that's basically how I got my start. I'm kind of, I guess, self-taught. As it relate, you know, as it relates to learning the television wrestling side of it, but Buddy Fuller and Terry Sawyer, you know, they did train me to hook and shoot, things like that. But the other way, the way the business is now, I'm pretty much self-taught. Steve, didn't know if you ever knew that story or not.
No, hell, I had no idea about that story.
Make sure to stick around after this podcast to get the latest headlines from the AP News Minute.
Hey, man, let me ask. Are we ready for some football? The NFL preseason is in its final week before the start of the regular season, and Major League Baseball action continues to heat up with the playoffs on the horizon. This week in the NFL, it's the Steelers versus the Panthers, the Rams against the Texans, the Raiders versus the Seahawks, and the Chiefs taking on the Packers. There's only one place that has you covered and one place we trust, betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code podcast1 or text BETNOW to 238-669 and receive a 50% welcome bonus. That's betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partners of Podcast One Sportsnet.
Football season is around the corner, and Podcast One Sportsnet has the best shows to help you build the best fantasy team in the league.
You can do it!
Break down all of the latest NFL news on Pro Football Focus Fantasy Football Podcast, then serve up some picks with Ross Tucker's Fantasy Feast.
Honestly, I think it's ridiculous in real life, let alone ridiculous in fantasy football.
Take a spin with the fantasy record or rise above with the Underdog Sports Fantasy Hour.
Just when you think this guy's going to come into a season fully healthy, it looks like he may not.
Dominate the competition and download new episodes of these shows and more every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Everyone knows about the risk of driving drunk. You could get in a crash, people could get hurt or killed. But let's take a moment to look at some surprising statistics. Almost 29 people in the United States die every day in alcohol-impaired vehicle crashes. That's one person every 50 minutes. Even though drunk driving fatalities have fallen by a third in the last three decades, drunk driving crashes still claim more than 10,000 lives each year. Drunk driving can have a big impact on your wallet, too. You can get arrested and incur huge legal expenses, and you could possibly even lose your job. So what can you do to prevent drunk driving? Plan a safe ride home before you start drinking, designate a sober driver or call a taxi, and if someone you know has been drinking, take their keys and arrange for them to get a sober ride home. We all know the consequences of driving drunk, but one thing's for sure, you're wrong if you think it's no big deal. Drive sober or get pulled over.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
Then, okay, you finally self-taught, but and getting reps in the ring and working matches. When was it that you thought you had a firm command on ring psychology, execution, you know, selling fire, comeback, or heat? Because obviously, I'm imagining you started off as a babyface.
Actually, I started off as a heel.
Well, I think that's probably an easier start, was it?
Absolutely. It was absolutely the easiest start,
yeah.
Because, you know, if you went out there to know what you were doing, you made a fool of yourself, it was okay for a heel, you know, to do that. But as a babyface, it was a, you know, it was a killer. But I actually got my start as a heel. And to answer your question on time, I would say it was probably 2 years later, actually got my break in the business where I started started managing Wayne Ferris and Larry Latham, the Blonde Bombers. We were a bunch of green guys that probably really didn't know psychology, really didn't know anything, but we were in the ring with Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee and the likes of those guys who could lead us and basically tell us what to do. Once that run was over, I later got into wearing a mask as the Nightmare, and I think about that time, and this was like 1981, but keep in mind, it was a lot easier to kind of learn the business and learn the psychology of the business, because the territory at the time was just full of veterans who could take you under their wing and share their knowledge.
Right.
You know, that's the main ingredient nowadays that all of the wrestlers are missing. So I would say, you know, I was fortunate. It took me about 3-4 years maybe before everything really clicked with me. So
one of the things that I always noticed in watching your work from way back in the day, and of course I was watching some of the matches before we talked today, but in working with you, you always had tremendous fire and you had a mean streak as a heel. Now, did this come from, it was a part of you, just who you were as a competitor going into a combat environment, although it's a work, or was this from the hook and shoot instruction with the Fullers? Because not everybody has fire, and not everybody has that mean streak. And I think to really have success, you have to have those two.
Yeah, you do have to possess that. And I think a lot of it had to do with my upbringing too, because grew up in a I don't want to say poor, but you know the South, and you know didn't really have a lot, but had food on the table. And there was a bunch of guys in the neighborhood who used to beat me up all the time, and I kind of learned toughness from that.
Right.
But I really believe the majority of it was my schooling, my farm work, and learning to hook and shoot. That's where, you know, I was able to go there when I was being a heel and needed that. It was easy for me to go there and, you know, bring that side of me out. It was real easy to do because I had a lot of pent up frustrations from those times.
Well, what ended up putting you and Kenny Wayne together? Because together is the nightmares. You guys were a hellacious tag team. How did this come about?
Well, actually, my very first partner, when the nightmares was established, I was actually sitting at home, and one day my phone rang, and it was Jerry Jarrett. And he was wanting to put a tag team together to work against Bill Dundee and Troy Graham, who was also called the Dream Machine.
Yep.
And so Jerry was like, you know, we'd like to come up with a name of a team and this, that, and the other. And I go, okay, well, what's the opposite of a dream? He goes, nightmare. And I said, that's our team. That's our name.
Yeah.
That's how quick that came about.
Yeah.
And so my first partner was a kid named David Oswald, and we were the Nightmares. You remember, you worked Jonesboro, Arkansas on a Saturday night spot show, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, during this time, we're wearing masks, and David's girlfriend, she would come to the matches, and she would buy a ticket, and she would sit in the front row. And when we were wrestling, she would be going, go, David, go. Go, David, go. Well, we were wearing a mask, and so, you know, that didn't work. So Eddie Marlin, the promoter of Jonesboro, said, hey, man, you got to make her stop. Well, he couldn't make her stop, so they ended up replacing David Oswald, and my second partner was, God rest his soul, Ted Allen. And do you remember Ted Allen?
No, I don't.
I don't know if you ever knew Ted. He was from Rome, Georgia. And Ted was a good technical wrestler. We had a good run for a bit. And then Ted had some issues, and he left the territory. And believe it or not, he left the territory making $1,500 a week back in the
Jesus Christ, that's good money.
I mean, that was very good money back in the day.
Damn,
you know,
right,
that was good money back. So, but that back in the day, that was good. So then, you know, Kenny was working out in California. And we got in touch with Kenny and brought him in. And he came in. We changed the name from the Nightmares at that point. We went as Nightmare and Speed. And then once we finished our run in Tennessee there, Kenny and I stayed together and formed the Nightmares. And that's basically how that came about.
So, man, after all these years in the business, how's your body feeling?
Steve, believe it or not, I'm doing real well. I'm in the gym now. 4 days a week. I've lost since last August. I've dropped 42 pounds, and I'm doing real well. You know, my body's responding well. no serious head injuries, no knee problems, no joint problems, nothing like that. Body's doing good. And June the 30th, I'll be 63 years old. And to be honest with you, I'm having the time of my life.
Man, you spent pretty much the bulk of your career in USWA, Continental, in that area.
Yep.
What was your favorite place to work?
Well, golly, Bill, I got to be honest with you. I always loved the Mid-South Coliseum in the USWA days. There was just something about going out there in front of 11,000 people, you know, back in 1978 or 1979, and just you know, feeling the energy that was in the air. I mean, it was mesmerizing. You know, I mean, it was just nothing like it is today. You know, but I mean, it was just something about it. Obviously, I love the old Southeastern days. That territory was run by Ron Fuller, Robert Fuller, Bob Armstrong, you know, and spent a lot of times there, you know, and I lived on the beach for years. So, hey, you know, you can't go wrong with that. I think it went, yeah, a guy by the name of David Woods, who owned a television station in Montgomery, Alabama, bought Southeastern Championship Wrestling from Ron Fuller, and I believe that's when it transitioned to Continental Championship
right.
Wrestling. Yeah, I spent a lot of time there. You know, I mean, that's probably the territory that I was probably the most over in, you know, if you want to use that term. But
yeah.
I spent the majority of my time there as a face, and got to be, I don't want to say a household name, but probably, you know, back in the day, that's probably what you could equate that to. So it was a good time in my life.
Man, I was live on the road back in the day. All of a sudden, you get into business. You got a wife and three kids, car payment, mortgage, and you're on a farm. You're doing work. You're learning how to wrestle, but it's hooking and shooting. So you introduce to Jarrett. Okay, you start working after they're all kind of don't know what to do with you because, you know, what you could possibly do in a ring. Okay, now you're hot and heavy and you're finding success. I ended up in a business with three divorces, Danny. How did the road treat your personal life?
Well, I am now on wife number four, if that will tell you anything.
Well, I am too. So we got something in common. I'm done.
But, wife number one, a wonderful lady. She gave me three wonderful children, Dwayne, Sherry, and April. And I'll just be, you know, I'll be flat out honest here publicly. I did her wrong. I mistreated her, and I'm sorry for that. But it was a part of my life. I chose the road life. I chose the glitz and glamour of the wrestling business because that's what I wanted to do. And it obviously caused issues there. Wife number two was a wonderful lady to me. She was great. But the business, again, you know, I was devoted to it rather than to her.
Right.
And another mistake, but lesson learned. Wife number three was just whatever. Somebody else I met in Louisville at the time. And she was a great lady. But at the same time, it didn't work out because I was married to her when I actually formed and founded OVW, and I had to pour all of my energy and time into it, which I did, and then basically that caused that divorce. Once I got OVW up and running, and then got the wheels in motion to where it was kind of operate itself, and I just had to sit back and, you know, oversee it and make sure that everything was going smoothly. You know, I was blessed to be introduced to a wonderful lady that I met, Julie. Met her 16 years ago. We started dating. We lived together for 14 years. And 2 years ago, we went to Vegas and got married by Elvis. And hey, we're solid, man. So the business had its up and downs. But as you and many others, I had a passion for this business. I love this business for what the business was. I did not get in the business to be rich. I didn't get in the business, for wealth, for a lot of money. I always put passion first because I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe, and I always tell any of my students, if you get in this business for financial gain right away, you're doing it wrong. You have to have passion first. If you have passion for something, then monetary gain will come because you'll be good at what you do. but passion first. That's always been my motto. And it's you know, it's kind of served me well. You know, it has caused me some heartaches and things of that nature. But, you know, I just believe you have to have passion in what you do, because when you have that passion, you honestly will become good at what you do. And then the monetary gain will follow that.
I got into the business just for the same exact reason, man. Changing channels at 7, 8 years old in Edna, Texas. Came across Houston Wrestling there in the same Houston Coliseum, and I fell in love with the business. So I did the same damn thing you did. I got in because I wanted to be a pro wrestler. That was the only goal, just be a pro wrestler. Well, once you get in, and then you know what you're trying to do. If you're a tag team wrestler, you want to have the tag team belts. If you're a singles wrestler, you know, you want to work your way up the belt system to be the world heavyweight champion. So being a wrestler is what I started off being, but then once you get in, you've got to have goals to ascend to the highest heights possible. But I do believe in the passion. You know, these days, you know, it's a whole different world and landscape, and you got a lot of former athletes coming from the football world, wrestling world, and, you know, wrestling is a logical step for them to try to make a living rather than getting a regular job. So I can understand that, you know, thought process as well, because for many people, it just is the end result, and it's a paycheck. So I'm down with that, but I was in from the same passion thing to you as you were. I fell in love with the business. But before we start talking about you found OVW in 1997, let's go back one second to the glitz and glamour of the professional wrestling life that you chose and kind of focused on more so than your family life. And quite frankly, I did as well. So the glitz and glamour of the road, it really ain't so glitzy and glamorous. It's a rough-ass grind out there, especially when you ain't making the goddamn money. You packed in about 3 to 5, however many guys in a hotel room, and you're riding down the road. And the way it was back then, Dan, in the Tennessee territory, for some reason, everybody rode down the road at night with the dome lights on. I don't know who started it. I think Lawler started it. But, I mean, we were drinking beer and whatnot, and it was just it was a party. But the main conversation in the car at all times was about the business of professional wrestling. As a green-ass punk, you know, trying to get a start in wrestling, man, I soaked in all that knowledge, asked questions, and got great answers from tried and true veterans, and it was just an absolute blast. But
that's how you learn. That's how you learn.
The road life, though, Danny, is not so glitz and glamorous, is it? It's a hard road.
Sometimes, and most of the time, it's an impossible road. The fans sitting at home, what they see on TV is just a small fraction of what that life really is. I mean, you know, we call it the glitz and glamour, but yeah, that's what we see on TV. But in real life, there really isn't no glitz and glamour because, you know, like you said, making those long trips in the car, you know, 4 or 5 people to a car, and not to mention 4 or 5 people to a hotel room. Sometimes, you know, you're sleeping in the floor because you can't really afford. Well, at the time, you couldn't really afford to get a hotel room for yourself.
And you're the junior guy in the room, so the seniority always got the bed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was, it was a tough thing. But back in those days, when you were making the trips with the veterans, when they were telling their stories and talking about wrestling, you learned as much in the car as you did when you were able to get out in the ring.
Absolutely.
You were soaking everything up at that point. You were taking everything in, you know. And, you know, this day and age, you know, no disrespect to anybody, but this day and age, it's kind of the blind leading the blind. There really aren't any veterans to share their road stories or any stories with them. So it's just really tough.
Danny, what were you guys doing back in the day? I came in, in 89, 90. I was a 90 rookie of the year, thanks to a high-profile program with Chris Adams. I didn't necessarily set the world on fire, but nonetheless had some TV presence. But so, you know, I come in, you know, 12 years behind you. And we got out on the road and spent a couple of years in USWA, about a year and a half, 2 years, got a call from WCW. Harley Race is, making some rounds. He's managing some guys. And, you know, back then, you know, Harley was kind of a self-taught chiropractor. And I jammed my neck up, had a few issues, and he put me in a full Nelson and jerked me off the ground. And I thought it was going to paralyze me. And then he laid me on a table and he wrapped a towel around my neck and he jerked my neck so hard I thought he was going to rip my head off my shoulders. And he goes, "How's that feel?" Or as he would say, "How's that feel, kid?" And although it felt like shit, I said, "It's good, Harley. I think I'm as good as new." And I never let Harley Race touch me again. And I say that with reverence to the one and only Harley Race, who I love to death. But guys were always trying to, you know, learn chiropractic skills, be their own trainers, because there was no medical personnel out there, brother. If you went to the hospital, it was probably coming out of your pocket. And so the boys tried to take care of themselves. What were you guys doing some 10 years before I came onto the scene?
We were doing the absolute same thing, because we had to be our own chiropractors. We had to be our own doctors. And there were times that, just to give you a quick example, one night in Memphis, Tennessee, Don Fargo, and you remember Don Fargo?
Absolutely.
You remember those big springs that we used to have that, you know, you would compress those things together and kind of get a good pump?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Don, he had oiled his body up real good with that baby oil, because he had a nice tan and everything. But while he was working out with that thing, because he had oil on his hand, it slipped out of his hand, and the end of that come up, and he popped himself in the chin. And boy, I mean, he had a gap in his chin right there. I mean, it was squirting blood.
Hard waiting, yeah.
So what Don did, he went in his bag, he got out a needle and thread, and he's in the bathroom, and he's stitching up his wound. Just like that. So we were our own doctors. We were our own chiropractors because, yeah, A, there was no doctor on the scene. B, we couldn't afford to go to either of those because the money just wasn't there at that time. So we had to do what we had to do, just like you did. So there was no difference.
What was your most serious injury you suffered in the ring? Did you get out scot-free, or a compilation of small injuries? How was your 20 years in?
Jim Cornette, he was managing a team called the Galaxians, Alpha and Beta. And that was, one of them was me. And it was actually it was me and Kenny. And we were actually the first tag team that Jim Cornette ever managed, by the way.
I mean, goddamn.
And so... And in Louisville, Kentucky, we were working a program with the Rock and Roll Express. And one night in Louisville, Kentucky, Robert Gibson, he went to give me a backdrop, and Robert fell with me, and I came down funny, and it really messed me up. I had to be carried out of the ring. I really couldn't continue. My back was so messed up. This was on a Tuesday night, so had to go to Evansville on the Wednesday night, you know, to wrestle there at the Coliseum. And I could not perform because I couldn't stand up. And so, had a substitute, but anyway, got in the, you know, sat in the car with Kenny, drove me back home. And I ended up going to I think my local doctor, and they wanted to do, you know, they wanted to do back surgery on me. And of course, I wasn't having any part of it. And, for a couple of weeks there, well, let me rephrase that. For a couple of months there, I was unable to actually really walk or get around. I was in pretty bad shape. And basically, I was told that I would never do the wrestling thing again. I'd missed about 3 months' worth of work. The territory was hot at the time. Lawler was booking the territory. And at the time, Lawler was making the payoffs. Mm. And I'd like to take this moment to say, and this will surprise you, that even though that I was not able to make the towns or perform in any capacity, Jerry Lawler gave me a full paycheck every week until I came back. And that's
unheard of.
That's unheard of. And he took care of me. And we were doing very well. I was sitting at home drawing anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500 a week and never having to leave my house.
God damn.
So, and this was 1983, Steve.
I know, that's a shitload of money.
Yes. And so, Lawler and I have always had a good working relationship. But people can say what they want about him, but because he took care of me in my time of need when I was hurt, You know, I will always help him any chance I can. But that was the one time that really I had, you know, a serious injury and didn't know if I was ever going to make it back. But I was able to overcome it and had a pretty darn good career from that.
So knees, shoulders, and everything okay? No major surgeries? Absolutely. No ligament damage?
No, none whatsoever.
Goddamn, you got lucky in that regard.
I actually, believe it or not, a year ago, I started seeing a neurologist because I was sitting around home kind of zoning out, and I thought I might have had some brain damage from the chair shots and the things that we did back in the day. So I actually went to the doctor and got checked out, but come to find out, it was just it was my sleep apnea causing some issues and the fact that I was overweight and out of shape. So I kind of changed my my life choices and, you know, dropped a bunch of weight, started back in the gym, and said, well, hell, I feel good. I'm going to start wrestling again. So, and that's, you know, I escaped all of that. So knock on wood, other than just being a dumbass, I'm fine.
Hey, well, before we let's jump into a conversation about OVW, its inception, you starting it, and where it is now. Because people are always asking me, and I get emails all the time, questions at steveaustinshow.com. Hey, Steve, can you recommend a good school? So with regards to your sleep apnea, was that obstructive or just because you were too heavy? Are you wearing a CPAP? What did you do about that? Because that's a serious issue that really no one ever talks about.
Absolutely. It is a serious issue. But a lot of it had to do with, I think, my weight problem. They wanted me to wear one of those masks, but I opted not to. I opted to, lose weight and change my diet and see if that, you know, helped rather than wear the mask. For me, it has helped. Most that would, you know, be for everyone, but for me, it worked. And so I'm able to sleep. I'm able to breathe better. And all that. So,
well, I'll tell you what, let me make a quick comment on that sleep apnea because, I was diagnosed with sleep apnea a couple of years back. You know, I'd be sitting on my couch and it was after about my second or third meal. I'm all, you know, and weight training, you know, eat 5-6 times a day, whatever. Hell, I'd be on my couch watching ESPN, let my food digest. And man, I just damn fall asleep. I was tired as shit all the time. And so I called my buddy who's one of my best friends. He's my doctor. And I said, Jimmy, I said, man, I don't know what the fuck's wrong with me, but I just can't stay awake. I'm tired all the time. And he goes, you know what, Steven? We ought to get you a sleep study. So, man, I go into this place in Beverly Hills. They hook all these electrodes and wires to me and this oxygen sensor on my index finger. So I go in there and do my process and go to sleep. And they video you while you're sleeping, all this bullshit. But it turns out that I had a severe case of sleep apnea, obstructive, my deviated septums, broken noses, you know the deal. All that kind of stuff was what caused mine. And they said, hey, man, you need to get on a machine. And so it turns out, you know, a couple of times I would stop breathing for up to 72 seconds at a time. Crazy stuff. And then my oxygen level went down to, I think, 65 or whatever percent, you know, rather than stay in the 96 to 100% range. So, man, they woke me up, put a mask on me, and, man, I tell you what, it was pure hell trying to get used to that machine for a while, and due to the nature of that mask fitting on your face. But, you know, the thing about it is I use a CPAP machine, and I use that mask, and at 50 years of age, I don't give a flying shit anymore. If I was on a dating scene and I was trying to find some young woman to come home with me or date somebody and had to put my mask on, it wouldn't be the most romantic thing in the world. When you push your button and that thing starts blowing that damn air into your nose, it's absolutely necessary for me. And, you know, that's what got Reggie White, one of the greatest, toughest football players of all time, was sleep apnea. And I have a bunch of friends of mine that are still in the wrestling business that use CPAPs as well. I'm not going to mention their names for their privacy. But, man, for it's just a little bit of a heads up for anybody out there who's heavy, overweight, or just big and bulky, or has a lot of nose problems like I do, go take a sleep test because that CPAP machine might be what saves your life. I don't know. I don't care where I go, Danny. I have my machine with me. I hook it up. And again, if I was, if I gave a fuck or if I was out in the dating scene, it might be kind of embarrassing. It was kind of weird for my wife to get used to, for a while at first. But, you know, again, I use a mask, and if you're in my shoes or you think you need a sleep study, go get one done and take care of your dumb ass. I'm glad you brought that up. And I've been meaning to share my story for a long time, but never really had cause to. And so that organically come up.
Kudos to you for bringing that up. That's pretty awesome.
Danny, let's talk OVW. How'd this come about?
Well, in 1993, I was still active at USWA. And I was actually winding down my career because I was actually booked in Japan, and I had given notice to all my contacts in the States that I was going to be gone for several months. And the reason was Dynamite Kid was retiring, you know, from wrestling, and they needed a partner for Johnny Smith. And lo and behold, I got the call, and I was going to go be Johnny Smith's partner, which to me was like, you know, it was a big deal for me. And so I'd given my notice to all my contacts in the States. I was going to be gone. And I was also going to Mexico at the time, and I'd given notice there. Well, 2 weeks before I was to leave to go to Japan, I got a phone call from my good friend, a guy I helped break in the business, Doug Furness. And he said that they had canceled me out. And I was just like, what? And he said that they found out that I had worked for another organization in Japan, because back in the day, you couldn't work for different organizations.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, my God, you know. And so I was kind of left without any kind of income or job, anything at this time. So I was like, oh, my God. So I kind of got depressed. And so I thought, well, over the years, people have asked me how they get in the business. How can somebody get trained? Well, I figured, I could train someone. And so I opened a school in Louisville, Kentucky, one little room, and I just, I put feelers out, and people just started coming. And that's actually how it started in 1993. But then it really ballooned in 94, 95, 96, and really took off. I had to have a larger building. And then once my crew of guys started getting, good enough, we started, to have the need to run some live events. So I got a bigger building that would seat, 100 people. And we started doing shows there. And then we outgrew that, and then I got another building that would seat 175 people, and then did well with that. And then about, I think it was 1998, I actually started doing a television show with my crew. I bought a bunch of television equipment. I read the manuals. I learned how to do it, learned how to do the editing process, and then for 2 years, shot television shows. Then Jim Cornette gave me a call. Bruce Pritchard at the time, and Jim Ross, and wanted to know if I'd be interested in helping develop WWF superstars at the time. And I thought, well, heck yeah, because this would be great. So 1999, I guess July of 1999, I actually got hired by WWE to be a trainer for their up and comers. So that's how that got started.
Now, I was watching a few interviews from Jim Cornette yesterday on YouTube, and, again, I was just watching stuff on you. It had been a long time since I talked to you. I know Jim came in, was booking for you. God dang, who else came in and booked for you? Paul Heyman came in and booked for you, didn't he?
Paul Heyman came in and booked for me.
But there was a disconnect after a while. What happened with the disconnect with WWE?
You mean when they severed the relationship?
Yeah, I think John Laurinaitis is working in talent relations at the time. And from listening to Cornette talk, Jim, he's a record-keeping fanatic and highly organized and detailed. And with talent coming in, out, I mean, you could always count on what was happening because Jim Ross had his shit together. And I'm not throwing John under the bus, but anyway, there's a disconnect between Corny and Laurinaitis. And then it just seems like for some reason there was a separation.
Well, I think what happened was Jim Cornette and John Laurinaitis couldn't see eye to eye.
Correct.
And JC, he decided to leave, and he went on his way. Laurinaitis approached me and said, look, we still want to do business with you because OVW is our future. I stayed with him, and at that time, that's when he brought Paul Heyman in to do the television booking, for for their guys. And so that lasted for a while. And then I think he went away. Then I think Al Snow came in.
Right. But when Al Snow came in, was that with WWE? Because Al Snow also came in when you guys switched over to TNA.
No, yeah, Al came in with WWE.
Okay,
and that lasted for a while. Then it was actually February the 7th in 2008 is when Laurinaitis came down and informed me and Al that the relationship was over. They were moving their operation to Tampa, Florida. I remember putting my hand on his shoulder and thanking him and saying, "Well, finally, I can now breathe."
Was it because you're being micromanaged so much?
Yes. Well, it was definitely micromanaged, and you know, I couldn't be the guy who I was. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I have no complaints, and I'm very thankful for the 10 years that I was able to train some of their top stars. I'm very thankful for the money that WWE provided me during that time of my life. But I was really thankful that I could actually exhale and kind of breathe, you know, once that came about, because man, it was tough times. It was good financially, but it was stressful otherwise.
But you guys had some high level guys come through there, you know, guys like Brock Lesnar, Batista, John Cena, Victoria, Shelton Benjamin, Charlie Haas, Randy Orton, Doug and Danny Basham, and then of course the list goes on. But man, you guys had a couple of blue chippers in there.
We actually, you know, we were fortunate. We were at the right time at the right place, and these guys came in and and learned, and then took what they had learned, and then took it to WWE, learned even more, and then became big stars. I mean, let's face it, that was, you know, we're talking 2000, 2001, and some of those guys are still headlining WWE cards today. So what does that tell you?
Right.
There's no doubt OVW had a big impact on their future, and it was good times for everybody. And their current performance center, it's a hell of a facility, but other than that, I really don't know anything about it. I don't know their training process. I don't know if they're developing the guys the way we used to develop them. I don't have a clue.
Well, let's talk about that in just a second, but let's just talk about one talent in particular. You know, Danny, being in the wrestling business, you come across some very, very unique individuals with respect to, you know, whether it's their physicality, it's how smart they are, how crazy they are. I mean, this business has some interesting personalities. But when a guy with the athletic stature or the genetics that a Brock Lesnar walks in with, what were your first thoughts when he first walked in? Because as soon as I saw that guy in WWE, or back when it was WWF, you know, I looked at this guy and I just said, this motherfucker's going to be somebody, hands down. And because I knew of his amateur background, I knew he just wasn't a big muscle head. The dude is a freakish athlete. But just from a visual standpoint, what did you think about the kid when you saw him?
Well, when I first met Brock and I sat down and I talked with him, two things come to mind. Number one, I realized from the get-go, there's no bullshit from this guy. He's a straight shooter. He's a straight shooter. And whatever he says, he can back up. I also realized from talking to him that he was coachable and that he would listen. But at the end of the day, he was going to do what he wanted to do no matter what, because that's just who Brock is.
Right.
Brock is the type of guy who he wakes up in the morning and he looks in the mirror. He challenges himself. I have never known him to be complacent. I've never known him to be lazy. He's always challenging himself to be better at whatever he's doing, no matter what it is. That's just who he is. And he's had quite a successful wrestling career. I mean, his amateur background, you know, speaks volumes as to how talented he is in the amateur world.
Absolutely.
But the fact that he was able to transition from the shoot world as it relates to wrestling into our line of work.
A work environment.
Work environment, and do it in a relatively short time really amazed me. I mean, here's a guy who's, 6'3", and was weighing 295 pounds, and while he was in OVW, hell, he was doing shooting star presses, and, you know, a guy that big, standing on top rope, doing a backflip, you know, and whatnot. You look at someone like that who's already genetically a freak, and to see this, it's like, oh, my God, the sky's the limit. Providing
you don't come across too many human beings with the kind of athletic talent that guy has. He's just an elite level. And then he came from a shoot background, goes to a work background, then goes back into a shoot with the world in MMA or UFC, as their heavyweight champion. Now back in a work environment, he's a hot property right now. But I just knew, probably when you saw him, you saw money, and there's money written all over the guy. But now let's talk about the wrestling school, the program there at OVW, I'm on your website, and this is ovwrestling.com, and you've got a beginner program, an intermediate program, an advanced program. Break these down for me real quick, and let's talk about them. And people always ask me, where can I go? Well, I'm telling you where you can go.
Awesome. Well, first off, anyone who's never had any type of formal pro wrestling training, we encourage to enroll in our beginners program. And that our trainer there is Matt Capitelli, who is a wonderful human being, who is a wonderful trainer, who actually he was one of the WWE Tough Enough, I think the first one, winners. And he's a cancer survivor, the whole nine yards, and he's an excellent coach. And that's a 3-month program. And basically you'll learn how to do forward rows, you'll learn some flat back bumps, and we see how you move and how you get around the ring. And from there, you have the option to re-sign or move up to the next program.
Okay, now let me stop you right there. When people listen to forward rolls and flat back bumps, and they think, oh, that's bullshit. No, those are the core basics which you must learn. And that was a big part of the school that Chris Adams put me through. You're doing forward rolls, you're doing backwards rolling. It's all about slapping that mat and a flat back bump, because that is how you must, you're going to be moving in the ring. You've got to protect your body and that movement. So I don't want anybody to just blow that off and say, oh, it sounds like a bunch of tumbling drills. Any school that's worth any salt has tumbling drills, and damn sure you learn how to take a bump. So I just wanted to throw that out there, Danny.
But you're exactly right. That's exactly right. A lot of people might think that's something that you don't need.
Well, a lot of people think it will assume that everybody knows how to do that. Well, hell, we did Tough Enough a while back, and Miss America couldn't do a forward roll to save her life. So you got to learn the basics before you learn how to do a working punch, much less the other things that come after that. Anyway, continue on, Danny.
Absolutely. Now, on our website, the intermediate program, it says that it is run by Frank Miller, who's actually my director of operations here. Frank Miller, also known as Trailer Park Crash, he's actually taken a hiatus from that class for now. And guess what? Yours truly, Danny Davis, is going to be starting that class again.
Awesome.
So this is going to be really good for anyone who already has some training, or for graduates from the beginner's class. They'll go through my program, and I will advance their training a little bit and find out where they are, psychology wise and whatnot. And from my class, they will also be bumped up to Hustler Rip Rogers. And I got to tell you, Hustler Rip Rogers, and I don't know how much you know about him, Steve, but Hustler Rip Rogers is probably the most thorough and the absolute best trainer in the industry today. He is as gifted as any man, woman, or child I have ever known when it comes to wrestling. Hustler Rip Rogers is to wrestling what Coach Bobby Knight was to IU basketball, a winner. He produces. I mean, he's so gifted. He's the best I've ever seen. I've known Rip for 35 years.
Right.
And Rip is an oddball. He's kind of out there, but if you you are a serious individual who wants to learn the wrestling game in his program, there's none better. He by far, not because he's my trainer, but because he is absolutely the very best at what he does.
And it's interesting because he's a guy who's traveled all over the world. And
yes.
I mean, I can't name all the countries he's been, but Rip's been all over the world. But yes. And I've never got a chance to watch him teach one of his classes. But there's just guys, when you say Rip Rogers and say, okay, well, how many world championships did he hold? It doesn't matter. Some guys are better coaches and trainers than a guy who would have been a 7- or 8-time world champion. That's just the way it is. And so absolutely. I've always heard that Rip was an excellent trainer as well. And, you know, going back to your intermediate program, you know, it's one thing, you know, you'll have a few months, a couple of years in the business where you think you know it all, but you don't. And it's good to go through these steps and stages from beginner to intermediate to advanced, because it's the little things that mean a lot. And sometimes it's something so simple. And this is just one example of someone, if you're just in a basic high spot, let's just say it's a tackle drop down hip toss. And so you take that tackle, and the guy stands there for I don't know, sometimes damn near 5 seconds, lollygagging around, pandering to the crowd before he continues on to hit that rope to get that hip toss. If a motherfucker's going to sit there and shuck and jive and dance around me for 5 seconds, I'm probably going to take him down because he's burying me.
Bingo.
And so, hey, man, a high spot is a transition in a match, because you're trying to work yourself out of a hold or vice versa. Your opponent is, and it's movement that's built into that match. And when someone takes that opportunity to try to get their character over, and if you're going to sell a collision, that's one thing, but it's all that bullshit which takes you out of the suspending your disbelief and buying into the product. You know, you present everything as a shoot. So it's those little bitty things, and that might have been a bad example, Danny, but it's the little things to me. And just as far as lockups, when you go back to watching a Bobby Eaton lockup, you know, one of the best lockups in the history of the business, all those things. And sometimes when, you know, the eye in the sky don't lie, I know you guys are filming these workouts, and we're going to get to that as well. But when you've got an expert eye on you saying, hey, man, that's good, but here's what you need to do to make that look better. And it's all about the presentation. A pro style of crisp and clean work is paramount, in my opinion, to making it as far as you can in the wrestling business. You can be the crispest, best worker you can be, but if your talent doesn't allow you to go to the top, that's just what it is. But at least your work will be presented in a pro fashion, which is, you know, something that looks good on television and looks good in front of a live crowd.
Absolutely, and I'm a stickler about detail. I'm very detail oriented when it comes to in-ring work. I will spot the little things that a lot of guys won't pick up on, but seasoned veterans, they know what it is, and I bring that to the attention. That's one of the things I'll be doing in my class. So. I'm kind of looking forward to that again. So
before we wrap this thing up, Danny, let's talk about the television aspect, because you were talking a while back about, you know, you learning how to write TV, learning how to edit. You bought all these cameras, and so you learned all that. How was that process for you? Was it something you gravitated naturally towards because you'd been in the ring so long? You don't strike me as a technology person, and I've been wanting to edit myself. How tough was that? I mean, I'm not knocking you, but how tough was that for you? Because, you know, when you come out of the ring and all of a sudden you get behind the camera and you're putting everything together, it's a whole different process.
It's a whole different process. But it was kind of hard for me in the beginning. But when I made that transition, Steve, you know, we were working on videotape. So it really wasn't hard. It really wasn't that hard. To make that transition for me. But now, especially in, you know, I'd like to touch on this, but like right now we're getting ready to upgrade our HD equipment, and we have a fundraiser going that I'd like to, tell you about, and I'm trying to raise some extra money there to, to help upgrade my HD equipment so that the we can take OVW into a new sort of a new media business, so we can remain relevant out there, you know, and we don't need the fans' help.
So you're using a crowdfunding platform?
Yes, sir.
And go for it. Break it down and tell us how that works.
Basically, if any of your listeners care about OVW, if they'd like to, keep a good independent organization, on the map and would like to help out, all they got to do is go to ovwrestling.com. It's our main website, and there's a link right there that's called Indiegogo. You just click on that link. It will take you right to the fundraising page. And, there's a quick 3-minute video of what we want to do. And if folks are able to donate, anything, $1, $20, whatever, we'll give them something in return. And all we're wanting to do is we're trying to raise $25,000 to upgrade my digital equipment that I have so that we can move into the next phase of our operation. Right now, actually tonight, we are going to be taping show number 812. So as it stands right now, my little company, Ohio Valley Wrestling, is the longest running wrestling television show in the on broadcast television in the country, not cable, but just on broadcast. And with the exception of WWE, OVW is also the longest running wrestling program, on the air today. So for a guy who came from a little town called Bemis, Tennessee, population of about 200 or 300, to be able to say that he's doing something, to me it's significant, because we provide a service for individuals who want to get in the wrestling business, and we teach them and train them to our very best of our ability to make them superstars, like so many who have came through our doors and went on to WWE, to producing a live television show and allowing the trainees to learn how to hit time cues that are so important, in the television business. And we try to prepare everyone for, their success in this business.
Hey, man, while you're online, you should get your car insurance figured out. Go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you can be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. Let's give big ups to TrueCar for supporting the podcast. Every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper for when you attempted to park somewhere in Los Angeles, or the mileage you saved by taking the bus all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar. Simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Then just answer a few questions. Navigation, moonroof, spacious trunk. This way, you'll know how much of a hit it's going to be, so you can plan ahead. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all states. All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Hey, man, don't forget to rate and review the Steve Austin Show on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends to check us out. Make sure you set your DVRs for Straight Up Steve Austin every Monday night after Raw. If you want to reach me here on the podcast, send an email to questions@steveaustinshow.com. I got a badass beer. It's called Broken Skull IPA. It's in demand everywhere. We're trying to up production from El Segundo Brewing Company. You can get Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in California. If you're not in California, you might be SOL. But stay tuned. And if you're looking to get a badass knife, I got two for you. Cold Steel Broken Skull, Cold Steel Working Man. Get them at my Amazon store. Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin, or go directly to coldsteelknives.com. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially TrueCar, Geico, Trojan, BioWave, BetOnline.ag, and the NHTSA,
That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. If you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description to this episode for details. Folks, if you see me in the woods or in the mountains, I'll be proudly riding a Kawasaki. And last but not least, don't forget, folks, we've got some badass new t-shirts, King of Attitude. That's right, King of Attitude. Now available at ProWrestlingTees.com, and that's the bottom line. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at SteveAustinBSR. Until next time, folks, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.